Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. It's a particular pleasure for me to say hello to a friend and to invite Jimmy Neary on this 50th anniversary of the opening of Neary's Restaurant in New York City on 57th Street near First Avenue. Friend, you're very welcome indeed, Jimmy Neary. How are you?
Hello, Adrian. How are you? Nice to be with you today.
On this great day, indeed. You know, there was the countdown clock to today, and I would assume that that was your daughter, Una, who at least arranged, because I know you wouldn't know how to do it no more than myself. But the 50 solid years is an absolute, that is a landmark in any man's terms, but it's a landmark for a landmark restaurant. And believe me, many accolades have been, assigned to Neary's Restaurant, and none of them actually without making reference to yourself as the ultimate host in New York City. And maybe it'll take us back, Jimmy, before your arrival in New York. As the crow flies, I would say we're about 12 miles or so from where I grew up in Antimas myself, if we could take in the town of Tubbercurry, though indeed when you were growing up there, it was little more than a village.
Yeah, Tubbercurry was it was a small town. I think it was about 800 or 900 people in the whole town.
Mm.
It's much larger now, but that's about all there was in at that time. And I started off in a drapery store, Eddie Gallagher's, in 1947. And I got a job there as an apprentice. My brother had worked there before me for 3 years as an apprentice, and he got the same thing I did. We got a shilling a day, so we got like 30 shillings a month. And we worked from 10 in the morning till 8 at night, five and a half days a week. Got a half day Thursday, and of course they were closed on Sunday.
My God.
So I worked there, worked with him for three years apprenticeship.
But you know, going back, to your arrival in 1954, those were good hours compared to what you faced when you came to New York.
Well, when I came here, I made my own hours. First of all, I went looking for a job, and in a warehouse, there was an Irish guy, a big guy, and they told me he hired a lot of Irish people. So I went to see him, and he turned around, and he took a look at me, put me up standing against the crate, and he says, "You're too small for this place," and that was the end of that. So I went into a coffee shop, and I was having a cup of coffee and toast, and who was sitting at the counter there? Only Martin Brett. Come home beside me. But he had come up here 10 years before me.
Oh, good.
And I said to Martin, "What happened to me?" He says, "Go down and see Maury Mulcahy at the Irish Institute on West 48th Street."
Right.
So I went down to see her. So he must have put a call in there too to her. So I went down there and I told her what happened to me in the other job. And she says to me, "Don't worry about your height. You'll be working tomorrow." I says, "You sure they won't turn me away?" She says, "I will not." She told me to go up and see Mr. Ed, he was the head, Ed Walsh. He was the head porter in the New York Athletic Club. And I went up there and I met him. And he said to me, "Let me show you now where you'll be working tomorrow." He didn't ask me my name. He didn't ask me where I came from or anything like that. So I was a porter at the swimming pool, and that's when it turned out. Washing the tables and cleaning the bathrooms and washing the showers and all that kind of stuff. What a porter does, right? And then he said to me, "I want to introduce you to the man that you're replacing after 27 years. And this is the guy come out. Now, I'm short. Mm-hmm. He was way shorter than me. He was about 4'11". He says to me, "You're the tallest guy getting this job in 27 years. So anyway, I worked in the athletic club from 7 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, 6 days a week. And I got $27 a week. That was 75 cents an hour back then. And then I was there about 3 weeks. And P.J. Moriarty, he owned two places in New York.
Indeed, yeah.
And you knew them, and your uncle Paul knew them very well, and Frank Durkin, Lord of Mercy in the Wall now.
Yeah.
But anyhow, turned around and I worked for him. He gave me a job from 6 in the evening to 12 at night, 6 nights a week for $24. Again, I was a bar boy, I was a bus boy, I was a porter. It gave me a delivery, maybe a dollar at that time. And I did that until, I think it was September of 56. And I was up in East Durham for a weekend. And we stayed in Mrs. Tarpey's. I think she was from Mule.
Yes.
Tarpey House.
Tarpey's. Famous establishment, indeed.
That's right. Yeah. Tanya, I think I gave her $25 something about it for 3 nights, but I only stayed 2 because on Saturday night my brother called and he said, he told me Starby, I was no where I was. When I came back, he had left a message to get back to New York that I had just got my draft notice for the Army.
Wow.
Then I was shipped off to Fort Hood, Texas, and down there a year in Germany, and came back home.
Yeah.
And then I liked the same 2 jobs.
Jimmy, let me ask you, when you did get that draft notice,
yes,
was there a big part of you that says, well, I hope now that my height, my lack of height, maybe I'll get out of it. Maybe when they take a look at me, they'll say, no, you go back home.
Well, actually, I had no idea what I was going to do, so I went up in 4 days in Fort Dix. We crossed in Fort Dix. And then at 4 o'clock in the morning, made us pack our duffel bags, break down our sheets, beds, everything, and turn them all in. And we went down to the mess hall and had breakfast at 6. And at 8 o'clock, back at the barracks,
mm-hmm.
We were put on the back of a truck, sent to a railroad station in Fort Hood, at the camp. And the first stop was Chicago, Illinois. So we stopped off there, and we got out on the flank, or whatever you call it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we were walking around. We thought we'd see a bit of Chicago. But of course, the MPs were there. That's as far as you got off. So we were only walking around about 2 hours. And then we were put back on the train again. And almost 2 days later, we arrived in Fort Hood, Texas.
Now, did you know where you were going or what your assignment
was? No idea.
No.
No idea. No idea. No.
And the other people that were being drafted at that time, were all different ethnic groups?
Yes, there were. Yeah, there were. Actually, there was 2 guys that was on the ship when I came out.
Really?
The 2 of those guys were, one was from Germany, and one was from, Mike Lanigan was from Tipperary. He used to be a hurling for Tipperary.
Mm.
We were on the same train. Well, we met on the train. We didn't know each other then, but we were on the same train.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Now, so your army, what was your assignment in the army?
I was assigned to the 3rd Armored Division, 7th Tank Battalion. I was in the 7th Tank Battalion. And on account of my height, I was tall enough and short enough to get into the driver's seat because the big guy couldn't get in there. So that I fitted in very well in the United States Army in the tank.
Well, now, let me tell you.
But, yeah.
There's a God up there somewhere. If they needed, a shorter guy, and actually, you drove the tank.
I did, yes, I did, yeah. That's loved good. It. 60 ton.
That's.
But I was.
I wonder, Jimmy.
Games.
I wonder, Jimmy, if on your resume you told them that, among other things, when you were growing up, you always were innovative and for a while indeed drove a taxi. Maybe that helped
yes.
you.
I did. Well, sure. By the way, the first thing you said to me growing up, I was growing up very short, but I grew up anyhow.
Yeah, well, now, just to clear the air, since we are broadcasting worldwide, let me tell you, you're not a dwarf, you know, and you've cashed in on that. But I have to say, though, I love getting my photograph taken with you because there are very few people that I'm slightly taller than, and you're one of them.
But you're taller than me.
And that's what I say, you know. I know what it's like getting my photograph taken with a load of lanky people, and it looks like I'm sitting down, you know. But I'm sure. Listen, let's go and move to. You were working in PJ Moriarty. So what about the business? What about attracted you? How did you know that this was where you were going to spend your life? Or did you?
Well, I had no idea. When I was in Eddie Gallagher's in Tubbercurry, I was in a drapery store.
Mm-hmm.
And between you, I did not like it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was dead, right? You know, you had to wait all
day.
But then I worked my way. He had a beautiful lounge bar, right?
Yeah.
And that's where I wanted to go. Because when my dad had passed away very young. And my mother on Friday night had went to Howley's in Tubbercurry for the groceries for the weekend and stuff like that. And we'd carry a basket, a big seat.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, she'd be up shopping in the front. You know, in Ireland, the bar is down
absolutely.
The back. And the grocery stop is up in the front. So I used to go down and I watched the bartenders. And that's all they were doing was pouring the pint and pouring the shot. And
yeah.
I said, that's my life. I said, because I'm not performing. That's for me. I love it. And I did eat back then. I was maybe 12 years of age. I said, I'd be 10 times faster than those guys behind that bar. And I loved it even before I ever left Ireland.
Of course, the pace back in Tubbercurry or in any part of rural Ireland at the time wasn't, the business wasn't built on speed, you know? It was very social when you think of it. The bar owner, the pub owner, and the bartender, and the waitress and the wait staff. It was very much a part of their job to be social. And if you were in a hurry, this was long before the fast food era. But the social atmosphere of Tubbercurry and of that job, if that's what drew you into it, it was a great magnet because you had decided then that that's what you were going to do.
The reason I loved it too was I wanted to be with people.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. I always wanted to be with people. Like when I was 18 years of age, my mother bought, I was still doing the same job in Eddie Gallagher's. She bought me a car and I made it a taxi, right?
Yes.
And then we get through with 8 o'clock at night. And then at 9 o'clock, we'd go into the car, all the lads in the town would get into the car, and we'd go to Charleston or Swinford or somewhere to a dance. And we'd dance all night. And that was like to be with people all your life. And that's the greatest thing to be able to, like yourself. You have met everybody in the world. It's a great, great feeling besides, say, being in an office and looking at the typewriter or whatever you've been
absolutely.
Doing in an office, right?
Yeah, not that either.
You need the word.
Not that either of us would make much of a fist at the typewriter, but that's a whole other story.
I can't even make too much thing with the phone. Never mind the typewriter.
For me, today is a remarkable day too.
Because you're 3 years behind me.
Well,
that's
right. I'm only 47. I'm in second place here.
You've helped me for the last 47 years.
But I want to tell you that on St. Patrick's Day of 1967,
yes.
After the parade, and I was great at hanging on now to my cousin Frank Durkin and indeed my uncle Paul O'Dwyer, who was the one who sponsored all of us to come to the country in the first place. And we were going somewhere. We were going to a place that was opening on St. Patrick's Day. And it was only afterwards that I realized that this was not just an Irish place, but that actually you and your partner, Brian Mulligan, were opening this. And you were represented by Paul O'Dwyer and Frank Durkin. At that time, and Paul, I believe, story is anyway that Paul, as much as told you, you were daft on the head to be starting a business right in an area of Manhattan where you wouldn't meet 10 Irish people to begin with. It wasn't the center of anything. It was a place that hadn't a great track record of successful business because. Anybody who put their fist to it didn't do well.
That is absolutely correct. Actually, there were three restaurants. We didn't even know it then. There were three restaurants out of here in 5 years.
Yeah.
And but what happened was, Brian, I tell you how it wound up when I bought the place. I turned around anyhow, and I was at Mass in St. Sebastian. I just got married a couple months before Eileen, and I lived in her apartment in Woodside from August until the 1st of March. But anyhow, I turned around and I had brought out sausages and bacon and black pudding and all that stuff that you could bring out at that time.
Yeah.
And Brian Mulligan and his wife Imelda were at the same Mass. So Eileen decided to cook them breakfast, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Brian had the time, and he thought this place in it. So we looked at it, and we called the guy up. His name was McKee, and he was a salesman. We called him up, and we met him up in the corner here at 57th Street, 1st Avenue, 7 o'clock on a Monday night. And we looked at the place. It didn't look like it looks now, but it was like a Chinese restaurant with no atmosphere.
Yeah.
So I think that was probably one of the reasons it didn't do well. But anyhow, we turned around and we put $500 down. I called Paul and he says, "Hey, you out of your mind? He put me on to Brian, right? And Brian says, go for it." Anyhow, we turned around and we opened it up, and Brian was the day shift and I was the night shift. And over here, maybe it's very slow in the beginning, because the day we opened up was a deal. Actually, it was a terrible day. It was lovely in the morning, but then there came freezing rain in the afternoon, and didn't they call the parade off at 2:30, I think, in the after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, if you couldn't walk. And we got a little crowd in.
One of the few times in the history of St. Patrick's Day that actually the parade was interrupted because of the freezing and the ice and the snow. But anyway, that was a memorable day to begin with.
Yes.
Go ahead, yes. Jimmy.
And the next memorable day was 19 years later when I called Paul and I told Paul I had bought the building.
Hmm.
And I said, I paid $1,375,000.
Yeah.
And Paul got scared when he had used these figures. So with that, he turned around and he says, "You better talk to Brian."
Yeah.
So he probably told Brian, "Give this guy a bit of this. Tell him to calm down and do something. He's great, right?" So Brian says, "What are you going to do?" I says, "I'm going to take a shot at it."
Okay.
So, and Brian came through and he says, "Go for it," right?
Wow.
So then I called Bill Burke.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill was from Tubbercurry also, as you know, Bill, right?
Bill was Tubbercurry, and in fact, Bill was the person who established Bank of Ireland at that time. That was before, you know, he went on to Country Bank and became the head guru there. But Bill Burke now, he was from your town. He was from
my hometown, he was, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, his friend Nate, they call him Martin here, but it's Burke. He's my best friend for 60, almost 70 years.
Absolutely,
His brother, yes. Bill told me he'd give me the money. And I called Mr. Sandler back, and I said, "I'll take the money. I'll take the building, right?"
Yeah.
And he says, "I'll have the papers to Mr. Dwyer's office by the following Thursday." Then I call home.
Hmm.
I said, "Eileen," I didn't say another word. She says, "What did you do now?"
"This is your wife, Eileen."
I said, "I borrowed $1,375,000. "You did what?" I says, "Eileen, I bought the building." And she said, "How in God's name are you going to raise it?" I said, "I have done the funniest idea." She said to me, "Do you know what you did to us today?" I said, "I don't know that either." She says, "You broke us for life." The children went off.
Wow. There was nothing wrong with your cheek, with your nerve, anyway. But at that point, then, you would probably have been the first Irish-born person to come to New York, establish a bar that may or may not take off, and now here you are buying a building. Bar owners do not buy buildings. Bar owners get a lease like everybody else, and if the business is good, at the end of 20 years, then they extend the lease or whatever. But very few would even consider buying a building. And go back to then, $1.3 million, that would be the equivalent today of $10 million in real men's language. Did you get the feeling that Bill Burke might have gone home that night and says, what the hell did I just do?
But I will tell you this. I don't know if he would have done that, but I'll tell you what I thought. Don't forget, I was here 19 years, right?
Yeah.
I knew what I was doing. I knew the rent I was paying. And I figured out in my little tin head, if I could get half as much money for the two upper floors, because it's a commercial building, right?
Sure.
But the two upper floors, if I am paying downstairs, I can pay that mortgage.
Amazing.
And that's what happened. I got they were an English firm. They were a pharmaceutical company. And this was a little office here in New York City, the two floors upstairs. And anyhow, I got, at that time, I think that I was paying $80,000 down here a year, right?
Yes.
And I got $50,000 a year I got from him upstairs. So that's $130,000. And my mortgage was $13,000 a month, so I was able to handle it. I had no money, but I was able to pay it off, and I paid it off, and I made it off. I had a 15-year lease. I swore to myself that I'd pay it off before the lease was up in 15 years.
The mortgage. And
I lease mortgage was up on the 31st of December 1999, and I paid the final payment on December 11th, 1999.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, that time. I remember the day that you paid that off, and we happened by chance to be in Neary's. And you were, you know, at the best of times, you're a bit cocky, but I'll tell you what now. You were thrilled to bits with yourself. You set out with a goal, which nobody would assume could be met. And there you are. You paid your mortgage ahead of time.
I did. And actually, I remember we were at a funeral, a wake out on Staten Island, the first cousin of my lady. Her mother passed away. So not too long after we bought it. And we're coming back. And there's nothing more beautiful than looking over at Lower Manhattan on a full moon night, cold November night, looking at that full moon and looking at Lower Manhattan, all lit up, all the skyscrapers and all that. And I says, Eileen, look over there. She says, for what? I says, we own a piece of the rock. Do you remember the commercial from Prudential?
Absolutely.
I says, we own a piece of the rock.
Still their logo, yeah.
Yes. She says to me, I hope it's not on the top of the tools before it's paid off. But we survived.
Yeah, not only did you survive, but 57th Street, when you bought that building, was a far cry from what it has been over the last few years, considered the most expensive street for commercial property in the United States. That should really say something. A lot of businesses come and go on 57th Street, but it is the most prestigious street for business in New York City, and as I say, many would say throughout the United States. Does that give you a great sense of security? Not that you need any further security, but that's a feather in your cap as well.
Well, actually, it's the oldest building. It's 2.5-story building, you know, right?
Yeah.
It's a brownstone. It is the oldest building on 57th Street from the Hudson River to the East River. And 57th Street, when I opened here a couple of years later, they did an art on 57th Street, and that said Fabulous 57th. 25 years later, it became Millionaire's Row.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 years ago, it became Billionaire Boulevard. It is now the most expensive street in the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm here.
And you're there. Well, you're there. I was going to say many days a week, but the day that you don't show up in Neary's,
yes,
we're going to call the guards. We're going to go out looking for you because you have a perfect track record of, and you have a routine which goes back for you and your wife Eileen, who incidentally passed away now 10 years ago. But you establish a routine. First of all, you live in Jersey, and your routine in terms of making sure that you're in the place every single solitary day is one that perhaps contributes to your amazing success. When did you decide that's what you were going to do, or did it creep up on you?
Well, actually, after Eileen and I got by the time when I got married, none of my children were born, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
No, but anyhow, we went to Mass every single day of our life up until the final couple of weeks when Eileen was really not able to go. And then we would go out to breakfast. We'd have the days, we'd do the jumble. And some days I'd have it done before. She'd even have the paper open, and she said, you were doing the car on the way here. You were not, and all this kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
We'd do that. And then I'd go to work. I'd be at work at 11 o'clock. And when the kids were in grammar school 2 days a week, I would leave here around 3 o'clock in the afternoon and drive over the bridge into New Jersey. Eileen and I would meet with the four kids. We'd have an early dinner together, and then I'd come back in and get home at 12 o'clock at night. And we did that all through their school years and all that kind of stuff. And then on the weekends, Eileen would take them on a Saturday and Sunday and drive them in. So we met quite often, even though we never saw each other much, that kind of way, you know. And she was a great, great woman to put up with it.
I want to ask you about your staff. At the screening of the film in the Sheen Center the other night, which was hosted by Cardinal Dolan, you, in the film, which we'll talk about another time, it's a 60-minute documentary on your good self, but you have a wait staff, and your staff in Neary's, it would appear that from once you get there, what do? You take their passports?
They're indentured servants. Yeah.
They're indentured, yeah. You take their passports and put them in.
They have no passport. Once they come here, they surrender their passport.
Well, that's one way to keep them.
They have to give up their passport. Well, actually, I start with the, as Cardinal Dolan calls Liz Farley.
Yeah.
The Reverend Mother. She's known as Reverend Mother here.
My God.
And he calls all the girls the Neary Rockettes. Well, Liz Farley on the 7th of June this year will be with me 50 years.
My God.
Noreen McIntyre is still here. She's here 49 years. Mary Finucane just retired after 48 years. Margaret Leroy retired after 48 years. And Mary O'Connor's here right now, and she's here 40 years.
It's amazing, and they do their own stuff, because half the time, or most of the time, you are not, other than I do know that your primary job in there, other than greeting your guests, is cleaning the tables, and you still, if that's what needs to be done, you seem like you've never gotten away from, you know, that job in New York Athletic Club, you know, and cleaning the lavatories and the like. It stood to you.
I tell you, when I worked for Peter Moriarty, right?
Yeah.
And I'd be busting the tables. He always said to the staff, and you know how great an owner he was, he always said to the staff, you have two hands. There's no table that doesn't have something on that you can't pick up with one hand and do the same from the other. So I would never walk through the dining room floor unless it's a see a table. I pick up a glass on one table, pick up a glass on another table, whatever it was, whatever plates or whatever it was. And I still do. I don't even think about it. But customers see that, but I don't even give it a thought. I love doing it. Kills the mice. Kills them. Shoot the breeze with them.
Yeah, and that you do very well, indeed. Celebrities, too many to mention, but probably if you were looking for a reference and you were to take the top, let's say, five, you would have probably the most loyal visitor and celebrity would be none other than our mutual friend, Mayor Mike Bloomberg of New York.
Yes.
Who has just he came there long before he had made any mark in any area, and that was his local.
Mayor Bloomberg lived on 66th Street when he came to New York first. He lived in a 5-story walk-up, and he was paying about $120 a week rent. And then he got on in the Wall Street area and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then he turned around, he moved down to number 2 Sutton. And I would say Mayor Bloomberg's coming here for 40 years. He was just an ordinary customer, like everybody else that came in. Nobody paid any heed to him.
Right.
We knew he was making money on Wall Street and all that.
Yeah.
But anyhow, he turned around and he became mayor of New York. And one of the greatest things he ever did for me in his life, and for me in my life, when they were honoring General Michael Corcoran for the Battle of Gettysburg in Ballymore County, Sligo, he went over to unveil the monument, and he brought me with him.
In his private plane.
In his private jet. And we landed at Knock at 6 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, and then we had 12 motorcycle cars, 3 police cars, head for Bell into Sligo Town and out to the Radisson Hotel on the Ross Point Road. We showered, shaved, had breakfast there. And then at 8 o'clock, we got into the car and with all the motorcycles and the people who want to work in Sligo Town, we went into Town Hall because he was receiving the freedom of the town. I think he was the 7th person ever to get it.
Yeah, that's true. And I was delighted to be,
And you were there.
That was a very memorable trip indeed. It was one of a couple of trips. On the second trip back to Knock, it was Mike Bloomberg, Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who cleared the way through his influence in Washington to get the international rights for Knock Airport. And it all began with that his first trip. He had been, obviously, to Dublin for business reasons and many times. But he had never been west of the Shannon. And it was a tremendous trip. It was great. But I knew, actually, there was an air of secrecy about how long the mayor was going to be there and where he was going to go next. And they were not big on giving information. But when I did, when I did see you getting off the plane, I had already been in Ireland in doing advance work for the mayor. But when I saw Jimmy Neary coming up, I said, this is going to be a quick trip.
No, that's not what you said. You took a look at me and you said, this is a short trip.
And
I know
was.
What you said. Thank you very much, Andy.
Yeah. I said, Jimmy will be back to enter the register before the night is before the day is over. You're actually, though, I again want to list some of the celebrities that we met the other night at the screening of the film, which, by the way, is called Neary's, The Dream at the End of the Rainbow. Tell us a little bit about your reaction to New York when you came here. Did you know that this is where, did you know you weren't going to go back? Remember that around that time, if you met somebody from home, they'd say, do you think you'd be going back? What was your own reaction to? Did you know that this was it? Did you know that this was your dream at the end of the rainbow? Had you arrived?
I would tell you. The day I arrived, my brother met me at the ship. I came out on the Olympia.
Mm.
And it was 11:11, and I got off the ship at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
And the first place my brother took me was to the Brickley, for John Kilkenny owners on 3rd Avenue, and there was the 3rd Avenue L. And he had Colin, I forget what Colin's last name, he was driving. And then we went up to the Bronx, and Mrs. McSorley was the woman, an aunt of the woman that sponsored me.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave me room and board for $5 a week. Now, my brother was there, and others, they were paying $15 a week. But I told her, I'm working in the ESC, she gave me $5 a week. So, anyhow, I did that. And
yeah.
I tell you, from meeting all the people, even when I was a port in the New York Athletic Club, I met everybody who was anybody there. And that was my, I didn't give two hoots what was getting paid. I loved this country. I loved it from day one, and I still love it today. But every year I'll make my trip back to Tabercorry, and which every village is now gone, but
yeah,
like most places. But I still go back. I go visit the grave, and all the lads that are still around there, and meet them all that I went to school with. Not too many of them left now either, you know.
Yeah.
But I love America. I do. It's been very good.
Among the people who came through your door, would have been like Mary Higgins Clark. You would have so many of the celebrities, and even the after party in Neary's the other night. There, you know, Police Commissioner Bill Bratton. You had so many from different walks of life. Were there times when there were celebrities, and are there times still when there are celebrities that come through the door and you don't have a clue who they are? Somebody points it out.
Actually, I would tell you, the celebrities that come, I know, that kind of way, you know.
Mm.
But there are people that come in here, and I found out later on after they were here, that they could have billions of dollars, and nobody pays one bit of heed to them. They come in and they sit up at the bar. I know who they are now, you know.
Yeah.
They sit up at the bar, no reservation, no, not. Well, we don't take reservations anyhow. But they sit up at the bar and they wait for a table and they don't want any show off that who they are or what they're doing. They're not looking for notoriety for themselves, and I am not going to give them up to anybody. Actually, there was one night here, I had six men in here, and between the six of them, that close to $100 billion. And it was the time that Ireland got a $60 billion loan from the EU.
Right.
And I said to them, I says, Ireland just got a $16 billion loan from the EU. I says,
mm-hmm.
But you guys can get together now and write a check and clear the whole thing off, and you still would never spend the money you have. But I didn't get anything for that loan.
St. Patrick's Day, and on this day, you know, the Golden Jubilee, the 50th anniversary of Neary's restaurant. You have, and we never know whether, in fact, they got paid union rate or not, or if they got anything out of you. But your kids, since they were knee-high to ducks, they became part of St. Patrick's Day. Whereas most people would want to or think that perhaps maybe the best place to be would be on the parade or yahooing on the side or cheering people along. Your kids knew where they were going to be in St. Patrick's Day, and in fact, they still do.
Actually, they are, and my son's, he has two daughters and a little boy, but two of his daughters will help out on St. Patrick's Day here now, right?
Yeah.
And then it turned around, and my daughter Anne-Marie, she has three boys, they all work here, they pick up the table, dirty plates, they bring out the water, bring them the menus, talk with them, they talk to anybody. Yeah, and Eileen now, my other daughter's here today, and she's got her son and daughter there, 9 and 7. They're on the floor here working right now, so they're all here. Yeah.
Your daughter Ona, I wanted to zero in on her for a moment, but she and her father before her always had the thought, both of you thought that having two jobs was definitely better than one. Tell us a bit about Una, and again, I don't want to, it's all covered in the film, but that's for another day. When did Una decide, and when did you decide for her, that coming and working in Neary's, that was something that would be good for her? And when did you decide that throwing her out and getting a career beyond that would be a better choice?
Well, actually, she worked here, and all my kids worked here during the year in the check room. She worked in the check room. My son worked in the check room. My other daughters worked in the check room. When they were 12 and 13 years old on the weekend, they make $30-$40 for themselves. They're in the check room doing their homework and everything. Mm-hmm. They all had their turn at it. And then, of course, they all went on to high school, all Catholic grammar school, Catholic high school, Catholic colleges. And anyhow, Una, Patrick, is, you saw him, he's still over there in the corner right now. He is a federal agent, and he has a big job. He's 26 years of defense now. And then Una is a partner, managing director in Goldman Sachs and compliance.
Mm-hmm.
And Anne-Marie got a master's in criminal justice. She walked away from that, and she went back to teaching for Open School. And only Eileen got her master's in education, special education. That walked away from the public school, and she teaches in for Open School. But to get back to Una, Una is now, as I say, part-time managing director in Goldman Sachs. And she learned out, and when she got to, became a partner and Goldman, she said to Mr. Lloyd Blankfein, the chairman, he said, "'Twas hard to get you, now we have you. We're glad it's over." She says, "It's not over." He says, "Why is it not over?" She says, "I have another job." "What do you do?" "I'm a waitress for 20 years. She says, "You're all what?" "I'm a waitress for 20 years. No more conversation. I'm not giving up. Put it in there." "Are you finished now?" She says, "I am not." "What do you want now?" "I never work on my high holiday." He says, "Zuni, we're closed on Christmas Day. You have nothing to worry." "Oh," she said, "Lloyd, that's very sacred. Not my high holiday." "What's your high holiday?" "St. Patrick's Day." He says, "Well, you may be traveling." "Oh, yeah," she says, "I've traveled the front door and into the kitchen room, the kitchen out the front door in my father's restaurant. Put that in there. I'm not giving that up either." And then a man at CNN, he was the head of the financial editor, he put out, 2 years later, he's a partner, right? And he put out a paper from CNN that the newest Goldman Sachs partner works as a waitress in a restaurant.
No.
And that went viral. But anyway, and she still helps out to this day. She's doing it today.
Jimmy, I don't want to get into trouble with your kids, and I want to get you off the phone, but we talked about this day for many the long year. We spoke about it on the 30th and the 40th, and today is a very special day, and I want to not only congratulate you for some of it, I think, is over the top, but you know that yourself.
I do.
And as I told you, you know, if you had as much more, you don't think it was coming to you. But I want to tell you, I appreciate your friendship through the years, and I would say that even after 50 years, and I don't want anybody to know, don't let this out, whatever you do, but would you believe that Jimmy Neary bought dinner for Anya and myself a month ago, and honest to God, I thought I was getting a stroke, you know? Of course, we probably paid for it 10 times over since then.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. All right.
I added on by the little bit.
But for many years, every year, while Mike Bloomberg, as mayor of New York, would be in our studio, we always mentioned Jimmy Neary's, and we always agreed that everything is overpriced. And in fact, you know, that you make such a great compliment. Most of what you're paying for when you walk into Neary's is that fella standing at the door from Tubbercurry, and here it is, 50 years later. Jimmy Neary, congratulations. Okay.
Adrian, I thank you so much for this interview. and you will be, no matter how old you live, and I live.
That's a touchy subject.
I still got 3 years on it.
isn't that ironic? No matter what, okay, you got the 3 years ahead of me. Jimmy, thank you. To your amazing staff, to your family, and to those who have, together with you, made today a very special day. Congratulations again, and we'll be seeing you before the end of the day.
Thank you, Adrian. Bye-bye.
And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, the celebrity Jimmy Neary himself celebrating 50 years as owner of Neary's restaurant, the singularly best known Irish restaurant in New York City the world over. Neary's, 57th and 1st. Irish Radio, let's get back to some music.